We're going to go ahead and get started with this August 9th meeting of the Citizens Police Review Board. We'll just start off with some introductions. If you haven't noticed, we are just at quorum today. Things come up, you know. But we'll go that way and then we'll wrap around. And we'll start with Sergeant Ray.
Sergeant Julie Ray, the liaison for the police department.
Stephanie Coleman.
Doug Hunt.
Jamie Thornsberry.
Reese Ellis.
Stephen Jeffrey.
Rose Woman Meyer, the staff liaison from the law department.
And with that, very piece of important business, we will move on to the approval of the agenda. Do I hear a motion for that?
So moved.
There's second?
Second.
We don't need to vote on that. Okay, of course. And moving on as well to the approval of the minutes. We've got the draft regular meeting minutes. They were sent out a little while ago. A little while is relative, some time ago, so we should have had some time to look at this. Is there any comments, amendments to the meeting minutes?
No.
Then I would entertain a motion to approve those meeting minutes.
So moved.
Second. Okay. And those draft closed meeting minutes also should have been mailed to you all. Same thing. I'd seek a motion to approve those minutes.
So moved.
Second.
All right.
Is everyone voting in favor of all those minutes?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. You know, yes. You have to ask if these things are by acclamation. Yes.
All those in favor?
Yes. Seeing no dissent, the minutes will be approved as well as the agenda. So we will just move right ahead to our special item on our agenda tonight. The interim chief of police, Matt Stevens, is here, and he is going to take some questions from us, but as well, I'm sure he'd like to say a few words about himself. So, welcome.
Good evening. Thank you for asking me to come. My name is Matt Stevens. I am the interim police chief for Columbia until they find the permanent position replacement. So I hope I'm not terribly disappointing for you, but there's a whole lot of this stuff that is brand new to me that I don't have a lot of experience or exposure to. I've got the resources and the people in other places to help answer questions if I'm not able to answer them tonight, so for sure I can get back to you with the right information. But just to let you know a little bit about the position that I've been in recently before coming into the interim position, if you think about the police department in terms of areas of responsibility, the part that I had was everything except for patrol and investigation. So it's basically like all the non-police stuff. So I've got the records unit, the evidence unit, the airport, building maintenance fleet, training and recruiting. It's a bunch of that, but it's not patrol and it's not the investigative division. So like I said, and the other part of that is each one of us gets different responsibilities and special assignments and stuff like that. So if you're asking me something and I don't know, it's just because I don't have experience and exposure to it, but I'll be able to help you with answers later on. The last thing that I just want to add just for clarity is with the interim role, Mr. Seawood is pretty set on believing that he's going to have someone hopefully named in November for the permanent position. So this is ideally for him, the community, the police department, everybody involved, a very temporary position. So there's not going to be a whole lot of changes one way or the other that I'm going to be allowed to make, because they would rather wait until a permanent person comes in to actually make those changes and work with you guys and other groups to come to whatever resolution that everybody needs to come to for the general public and everybody involved. So my scope of control is going to be somewhat limited, just full disclosure.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here tonight, you know, to have some conversation with us, because I know we're going to ask you some questions. But, you know, if you have questions of us in as a follow up or in addition, you know, feel free. I do want to go ahead and ask some of Xavier's questions, because he is absent here tonight. And he and I, we kind of had some similar thoughts on a couple of things. And Some of these are a little more broad, just to kind of get your idea of policing in general, you know, since you are in this role. And one of the questions that he had was, in, you know, in your mind, what does a proper arrest look like as it, you know, relates to handcuffing, telling individuals of a crime, noncompliance? You know, what does an ideal arrest look like?
Are you talking more like procedurally, like going through the motions of taking someone into custody?
Yeah.
Generally, it's situational. It depends on what the crime is. It depends on what the surroundings look like. Depends on the cooperation, the compliance of the person that, you know, that you're dealing with. But generally speaking, if you're arresting someone, you're telling them that they're under arrest. You're asking them to put their hands behind their back. You're placing handcuffs on them. It's kind of like a pin where you can push a button in the handcuffs that keeps them from tightening up once they're on someone. So you would do that so that they're not going to cut into their wrists and restrict that anymore, but so that they're secure on their wrists. You would search them and any property that they had on them. A lot of times, just depending on, like, again, situational and locational and all of that, what that is, but you would probably remove the property if you were in a position where you could do that. And then if you were transporting them in a car, you would look through the back seat of your car and make sure there was no contraband in there, and then you place them in the car, secure them. If you had taken property off of them, you would put the property generally in the front passenger compartment, but not where they are. You could put that in the back, but you keep it secured in a location away from them, and then you would transport them.
Okay. I've got one more kind of question that is not super policy related, and then others may have questions as well, because I do have some policy ones. But and this came from a community member. I talked to some folks to try to see what, you know, they were interested in learning from you. And one question that I came across was, how do you plan to help the next police chief, whomever that is, transition into this role? You know, in addition to that, in this very brief time that you've been in this role so far, have you encountered anything or experienced anything that's added to this perspective that you're trying to build?
So to answer the first part of the question, I think some of that's going to be dependent on whether you have an internal promotion or whether you have an outside candidate that fills the permanent position. So that's step one. If you have somebody internally, they're probably going to be a whole lot more familiar with the processes, the people, all of that front to back. And they may not know all of it, you know, step by step. I don't know all of it. This is really, really brand new, and it's like drinking from a fire hose, really. And so you're getting all this information thrown at you, and I'm absorbing probably about that much out of this much, because it's just so much. So if you have somebody internally, they're going to already have a few of those things, those boxes checked, because they're going to be familiar with it. If you have somebody externally, there's going to be an enormous amount of opportunity for them to learn different things from different people. So I think a lot of that is you give them the resources in those areas and make those introductions, and then you back off and let them do what they do, so that way they can learn from the expert in that field. So, but you would have to introduce them to a lot of people. They're internally, policy, procedure, process. I mean, they're going to have to figure out what floor of the building their office is on. I mean, there's so much. In this role, what I'm trying to do really is just be as stable as I can in the meantime, and make the transition as smooth as possible for whoever that person is, internal or external, and get them where they need to be as fast as they can be a good resource on the backside of that, but also not be in anyone's way when they take off and start to fly on their own.
I want to let others get in here before I go to anything else that I have. Thank you for that. There are some other questions that folks have before we get into policy.
How many years have you been with CPD?
Next week it'll be 18. Not counting.
Happy anniversary.
Thank you, almost. Yeah, right. I got hired in August of 2005.
So I'm just curious, broad perspective, what changes have you seen over the 18 years of being at CPD?
Internally or community-wise?
Both.
Internally, it's hard for me to give a good, clear perspective on that, because when you're on nighttime patrol, for example, the stuff at the higher level, you have no idea what's going on. It's really not until you get to probably an assistant chief level where you really get a peek behind the curtain. So it's hard to say, as you're making that jump, what's going on here, because I'm so far removed from that anymore, being in a position like this. It's hard to know exactly what's different. The department it's grown and it's shrunk, if that makes sense. There's been areas that we have taken away from. There's been areas that we've added. We've got buildings now that we didn't have before. You've got additional staff in different areas and positions in the department that we haven't had before or had any need for. And as it grows and expands, you're filling those roles and trying to incorporate that into an organizational structure, chain of command, what the job title looks like, what the responsibilities for the position look like, all of these things. Community-wise, we've annexed a lot of land compared to where we were at in 2005. Example, Scott Boulevard was a little two-lane road back then, and now it's four lanes. So as an example, land is spread out, which now you're getting more people in town just because you're annexing more land. On top of which, you've got more people in town anyway at this point, so population has grown pretty decently over the course of time. Nature of call volume has changed quite a bit. When I first started, if there was a shots fired call, that was a huge deal because it didn't happen. Like a confirmed shots fired call you just didn't have those. And now that's a fairly regular occurrence in town. So you've got kind of a turn of just even the calls you're going to. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot different. Schedule changes, personnel changes. Every time you have personnel changes, there's a different way of doing business because somebody brings in their own philosophy, ideas, and agenda, and then everybody needs to basically adapt to that or find a new job. So that's changed over time.
What about staffing? I'm just curious what it looked like back in 2005 versus the numbers today. And you mentioned the growth of the city. In your opinion, are there enough officers to adequately cover and police?
There's not, but I don't. So it's hard to say exactly. So let me back up. In 2005, so it took me 2.5 years to get on at the police department, and I had a college degree. Couldn't get hired because you had such a large roster of people that wanted to work in law enforcement and at the Columbia Police Department, that if you didn't already have the Law Enforcement Academy or experience, you weren't getting a chance. So 2.5 years it took me just to get on. At this point, we're paying for people to go through the Law Enforcement Academy just so we can get them on. Mm-hmm. So totally changed. So the staffing thing, and it's a nationwide problem. It's not unique to Columbia. There's a lot of people that are struggling with getting officers and retaining officers. So that's a constant struggle, and you're always chasing that number.
Thank you.
You mentioned that that's a nationwide problem. I'm sort of imagining, and I guess the way I would ask this question is, suppose we hire a new chief from outside. If it's common in all communities across the United States we're having trouble recruiting police officers, it's probably true that every community has a different profile in terms of what the underlying causes for crime and incarceration are. That might make one city different from another. What would you say to somebody coming in about what the underlying causes of crime and incarceration are in this city that might be different from if they're coming from St. Louis, if they're coming from Cincinnati, if they're coming from somewhere else?
Let me give you an example of just of the ones that I know of personally. Let me give you a different kind of example, so it's not going to really hit on where you're asking. We get people in, and we're very, very clear on the front end about what you're going to see, the hours that you're going to work, what the pay is. You're going to work nights, and you're going to work weekends, and you're going to work holidays, and you're going to get paid X amount. and you're going to see dead bodies, and you're going to see all of these things, and you're going to experience all of these things. And the new people, totally good with it right up until it becomes reality.
Mm-hmm.
And the second that it becomes reality, somebody quits because they got punched in the face. That's police work. It's like, that's just inevitable. It's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, well, I don't want to go to work and get punched in the face. And they quit. And you have somebody that, like I said, you know, regardless of what the incident is, it's their incident that registers in their mind that this is not where I want to be and what I want to do. So a lot of the stuff that we're seeing is just that, where once the reality sets into what it is, and whether that's the long days, the long hours, the having to work on nights and weekends and holidays, and that becomes a reality, and all of a sudden, that's not what people look at and go, I want to do that for the next 25 years. And that's, they hit their breaking point, or they start looking around and they find different employment where that's, they don't have to do that. And that's what we're competing with.
Yeah. To try to clarify where I was going with that, maybe we can think of it as more of a prevention question than an enforcement question. I'm thinking that what you do in different communities to discourage crime and the need for incarceration might, you know, vary from place to place. I don't know how much. What would you say on the prevention side would be the role of a policeman in Columbia?
I think a lot of that is just getting out and talking to people. It doesn't have to be. Ideally, talking to people isn't reactive. Mm-hmm. It's not because you're getting called to a 911 call. It's not because you have to be there. It's because you want to be there. So whether that's walking in and talking to business owners, whether that's going through neighborhoods, whether that's participating in community events like when they have National Night Out and, you know, you have the social events that you can go to. I think a lot of that is when you can get some of that on the front end and you're meeting people and conducting business that way. I think that helps counteract all the negative stuff that you do and that you see and that you experience and that the calls that you go to and all of that. Because this is on your own. It's completely proactive, and it's not one of those things where you're being dictated what you're doing by dispatch on the radio. So that's one of the big things that we've tried to push. And Chief, that was one of Chief Jones's big things too, was get out in the community, get to know people, not because you're being responsive to something, but because you're being proactive to that.
I've got a couple of questions that are a little more. I know you say you're doing this in an interim capacity, of course, but it's the interim police chief. So, you know, I got to ask the police policy questions. And,
sure.
You know, one of them is, you know, there's been a pretty considerable amount of public discourse on the use of some smart technology in policing, especially advanced surveillance tools like we debated the city council debated last fall, the Fusus technology. And so, you know, in your view, are those tools necessary for more effective policing, or are some citizens correct to be concerned about, you know, abuses of privacy?
I think it depends on what tools you're talking about. People have different ideas of what's what, and I don't know that you can collectively throw all of those things together and get a solid, clear answer. Like, for example, the technology that we were talking about, really what that does is it the city or Columbia is not putting up additional cameras. What we would have been doing if we had gone with that system would have been using cameras that were already in place. And I mean, when you walk into Walmart or, you know, another box store, they've got cameras that are right there that you're being recorded when you walk in. And if they would want us to have access to that, then we would. And if they didn't want us to have access, then we wouldn't. Or if there were certain ones here or there or whatever else, it's not an all or nothing kind of thing. So you could handpick how that looks. The benefit to doing something like that is it has a varying effect on a lot of different things. If you can identify somebody from a crime from one of those cameras very, very quickly, and we have access to that, we're not waiting for a business owner to come in the middle of the night to give us access, which maybe right then if they're on scene, but the likelihood of that is very, very thin. And so then that puts you that much further behind. It also identifies or helps identify your suspect, because at that point, then you know what you're looking for. If you're looking for a white guy in a blue uniform, they're not going to stop you, and they're not going to stop you, and they're not going to, like, they're not going to stop you guys. So it narrows down that scope and that field. So it has a whole bunch of varying effects, but it can speed up what that investigation and what that process looks like. So, for example, that was the one that we were looking at, and that's why we were looking at it.
I want to talk about something that's been brought up to very recently during the budget conversation that happened with the city, and was also brought up by a community member. But, you know, as you know, the city has solicited some vendor proposals to provide co-responder services. And, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, that vendor would hire the co-responders who would work in tandem with the officers. This is the city's description from the budget. And department staff to assist persons experiencing mental health crises. And that funding would come from the Department of Health and Human Services. And so my question is, you know, what is, you know, as you know now, you know, what is the department doing to prepare for the implementation of those services? Have you heard any feedback from officers on what they think about that? And, you know, what does that look like, I guess, in greater detail, as much as you're familiar with it? Because I think that there is a worry that, you know, these community partners aren't going to be, you know, empowered to do what they need to do in these crises that police officers may not be fully equipped to handle.
So I'm a little bit familiar with it. That was not one of the projects that had been assigned to me, so I'm new to it by like 4 days.
4 days, yeah.
but I can tell you a little bit about it. Step one is you've got to find somebody that can check all the boxes that you need checked. Otherwise, you're making a bad investment. So it's got to be, for example, you don't want somebody that's only going to be able to work Monday through Friday from 8 to 4, because that does not cover everything that you need covered. So you have to lay out stipulations that you need, and the way that that is going to work, and make sure that whoever it is that's bidding on this can meet the criteria that you set forth for making that happen. And quite frankly, the problem that we've run into with that is that's very limited options that you have on the outside of that that's feeding back to us. So internally, nobody's opposed to it that I have heard. It's one of those things that we want it to happen. Because if you call 911 and hang up, the cops are the only ones that show up. And we end up going to a bunch of calls that we don't want to go to, but we're the only ones that go. So if you get into situations like that, you're almost there. You don't really have an option of being there. So anything that we can throw into that whole process that helps that, you're not going to have resistance from. The problem is going to be finding somebody that checks the boxes that we set forth, that we say we have to have 24-hour-a-day coverage, and it's got to be somebody that can work with law enforcement, and you know that you've got this exchange and everybody's on the same page, so that there's not any misunderstanding about roles or positions or who's doing what, and somebody that can do and understand why we're there, what our intentions are, and what we're trying to do, and then when we need to let that go, somebody that's really comfortable being in that position to take that over.
And you know, for the time being, until that's fully implemented, I think there are, you know, without commenting too deeply about it, I think that there are some folks who would say that there seem to be some gaps in standards and approaching community members having mental health crisis, for example. And so, you know, what in your mind could the department be doing in the interim, you know, to address those gaps, if anything?
Well, and that's the thing. I don't know that there is much.
Yeah.
If there is, I don't know what it is. I would be wildly open to suggestions and ideas, but I can't answer that with clarity because I don't know what would be the best approach. I think what we're trying to do is very much a long-term solution versus a short-term band-aid of sorts, and that takes time, obviously. The need is there, and you know, if you get the opportunity to do that, you want to make sure you hit that right out of the gates and you get everything you need and you do it right, because if you implement that wrong and you're committed to a contract and it doesn't go like it's supposed to be planned, then it doesn't serve the purpose that you intended it to serve. The community's disappointed. There's a bunch of blame and finger pointing that goes around, and it's all because you're trying to do the right thing and something got screwed up. So I think a lot of that, you have to slow roll that a little bit so that you get it right the first time and it's smooth.
Well, my only recommendation is to, you know, and you don't need any advice from me necessarily, but I'm going to give it to you anyway, is to try to bring in different parts of the community, because there are some people in the community that do some work around these issues. And, you know, I don't know how inclusive this process is in trying to figure out how implementation works, but I think if that ask is solicited for, it'll probably be answered. But I've got some other questions, but I don't want to monopolize this. Anybody else? Okay. Just a couple more, I promise.
Okay.
So, you know, looking at that vehicle stop data that comes from our Attorney General, in your view, why do you think it is that for the last 20-odd years or so, the data has shown that officers in our state and, you know, in this city, of course, but not to the extent of other, you know, localities, are pulling over, ticketing, and arresting black motorists at disproportionately high rates? Because in Columbia, the black population is something like 10%, 11%, but they make up the majority of searches and the majority of arrests. But the contraband hits aren't that dissimilar. I think when you take the average number of, or you take the number of searches divided by the number of, you know, contraband that's found, the city on average, it's like 52. These numbers probably don't mean a whole lot without the context, but I recommend that you read, anybody reads the 2022 report. I think the city is 52. White residents are, or rather, I may have the, city is 55. White residents are 52, and black residents are 58. So, you know, for me, it doesn't seem like that disparity is because minorities are committing large and disproportionate amounts of crime. And so I was wondering if you had an idea for why that disparity seems to persist over all these years.
That's the $1 million question.
That is the $1 million question.
Like, everybody wants to know, and nobody can really put their finger on it. That's the whole thing. So what we've started doing is, so the records management system that we have it's not well. And it's very bulky, and it doesn't do what we want it to do. So we're looking at getting a new records management system. We've also put different things in place that we could, in terms of trying to track all of what you're talking about as best as we can. So there's been different things that we've added to that will try and track, you know, is it, what instigated the stop?
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure you guys have heard that. It's all the stuff that we've been trying to do. And then additionally, I'll be curious to see when the next round of numbers come through and they have time to analyze that, because we're not doing searches anymore on odor of marijuana. So that's going to be a big thing too. So I don't know what that's going to look like or how that's going to get sorted through. But it'll be interesting to see what changes and how that looks when they start to evaluate those numbers as well.
I think I've just I've got one more question, but I, you know, if anyone else has anything else, you know, feel free after this. And I think this is especially relevant to us and for you in this capacity. You know, the legislature very recently attempted to further limit our oversight ability through the crime omnibus, which was Senate Bill 189. And that action, of course, was vetoed by the governor, but it's pending a veto override next month. And so I am curious, what is your view on boards like ours, which are organized to provide civilian oversight of police departments?
To be completely honest, I've had little to no interaction with CPRB. I mean, full disclosure, I'm not going to stand up here and pretend to tell you a whole bunch of stuff that, you know, and blow a bunch of smoke at you that it doesn't make good sense. So if I sound ignorant on the matter, it's because I am. I've had very, very little interaction, knowledge of, experience with, exposure to what you guys do. So it's hard for me to say one way or the other exactly what it should look like, what it needs to look like. I think the more involved I get in it, I'll end up having an opinion at some point. Right now, I think it serves a purpose. It's just one of those things where, just like what everybody talks about all the time, is where's the boundary? And I don't know where I think the boundary is right now. If I become more involved in this, and I'll find it. But right now, I can't tell you exactly where it is.
By the end of this, you will be lobbying for us in the legislature, I promise.
I have a quick question.
Please.
You had mentioned earlier how the shooting calls are a lot more common now. What are like the top three or four types of calls that are getting? Is it domestic violence? Is it shootings? Can we get that information?
I can get that for you, but I don't know right off the top of my head. You want it for like last year, last 5 years? What kind of time frame are you thinking?
Since COVID happened, I would say the last few years would be good, just because it's probably going to differ with that.
The great divide.
Yeah.
That'll be in the state report. I can pull that information tomorrow and send it.
Thanks.
Would you like the top five or?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Fine.
And then we had one more request for some specific information. It related to folks who are unhoused, homeless, impacted by homelessness. The question is, the Missouri legislature recently passed a law that banned those impacted by homelessness on state-owned property, and so there's a report that shows that shows 84 individuals impacted by homelessness have been arrested since February in Columbia. Would you be able to get us information telling us how many of those numbers are related to that law change? Possibly
zero.
Oh, well, could you expand on that?
So since January, there's been 1,000, these are rough numbers, so don't take me exact, but the best that I can do with this. There's been roughly 1,328 incidents, CAD notes, calls with police for unhoused individuals. 139 were arrested, so roughly 10%.
And is there a breakdown of what, those arrests are for? Is it just purely, okay, yeah.
So majority of the charges, first degree trespass is 29%. Detention for evaluation is 10%. Warrant arrests are 10%. So those are your biggest, which makes up just short of 50% of all the arrests within those three. But in our record system, it doesn't show that we've made any arrests for violating on state-owned land.
I do not believe I have any more questions, but if you'll give me just one moment, I'll make sure that that's true so I don't send you off prematurely.
I kind of have one. I'm trying to organize it in my head how to say it.
Please.
So you said that they're trying to get someone appointed by November. So what do you see yourself doing for the next 3 months? I mean, as you're not going to make any big policy changes or anything like that. We understand that. But what is going to be your biggest focus, I guess, would be the biggest question I'd ask.
There's a lot of administrative stuff that goes on that you just have to keep up with the day-to-day, that kind of stuff. There's liaison between different groups. There's a lot of administrative functions that that become priorities if they don't get done. Just paperwork in general, hiring people, approving expense reports. There's any number of things coming to the CPRB. You've got engagements like that you go to. So a lot of that it's really more administrative than it is anything else. It's not the fun, glorious, exciting stuff where you get to go in and start changing things around. It's really just more keeping the flow of regular business going so that part is smooth and taken care of and it's not disruptive to anybody outside of that. So it's a lot more of that than it is, like I said, going in and adding a new unit to the department or reorganizing and structural changes and stuff like that. So it'll just be more holding the horns. Thank you very much.
If that's the last question, then thank you for joining us. I appreciate you taking our questions. Hope to see you again, and best of luck to you.
Appreciate
you
all.
Thank you.
Thank you all
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
So now we will continue moving on in our agenda to old business. We are talking about some event planning for that September 14th special meeting on police policies 300 and 447. Rose gave us some questions to kind of think about in terms of what planning for that might look like. And I'll go through some of them. I think, you know, the biggest, probably, I know the most pressing question on everyone's mind is what time should this meeting start? I thought 6 p.m. You know, because we'll meet the 13th, that's Wednesday, 14th, Thursday. I can't, you know, if we can send out a poll about that later, but just in, you know, in my mind, 6 p.m. made sense. If there are other thoughts on that, welcome to hear them now. Otherwise, we can do a doodle on that because we're just at quorum here. So there may be some folks who can't make six, but anyone here know they can't do six? This would be the 14th. Well, okay, well, that's a good sign. And then a question of how the room might be arranged, you know, classroom style, a chevron or big U kind of round tables. I was of the mind maybe a U so we could all look at each other and talk to each other. But I'm not opposed to any other ideas if people aren't a fan of the U. I know very important details we're having.
If you want a U, do you want just the board at the U, or do you want anyone who comes to be at the U?
In my mind, anyone who came at the U, but then maybe the board at like the base of the U, the straight part of the U.
The horizontal part?
The horizontal part, thank you.
Can you maybe, Reese, just explain like a little more detail?
Yeah.
The meeting, just for maybe the public that doesn't know what our plans are, or?
So we've had these policies on our agenda as a continuing item for the last few meetings, and so we thought that it would be better to just dedicate some set-aside time to have a more community-involved discussion on the policy ideas, and from there we could talk about any prior proposed policy recommendation that we'd have on these, and hopefully through that public engagement, you know, create some new ones if some should exist. And so in terms of what would be on an agenda, this may be redundant, but if I am missing anything, please, you know, anybody. A call to order, introductions, overview of policy.
Can you slow down?
I'm so sorry. Yes. Yes.
Introductions. Okay.
An overview of policy 300. As well as an overview of policy 447. And then should there be, because we do get not insignificant a number of email with, you know, different citizen input, so should there be any introduction of citizen submitted written material that we would have gotten beforehand, either, you know, if it makes sense to read it, you know, we're not talking about 15 minutes reading it out, or at the very least, you know, providing it to the people there for
prior to.
And then discussion of any prior proposed policy recommendations. And then the other part, the final part, at least in my mind, would be the roundtable public comment, which would be a bit like our public comment now, except and I would envision us being, you know, choosing to respond to all the public comment, because we would try to be, you know, soliciting ideas during that kind of session. Maybe it'd make more idea to call it a work session as opposed to a special meeting, but
right, because is there like time limits and things still in place, or is this more informal discussion?
So
depends on how you set it up. I mean, that's,
okay, I didn't know if there
yeah
was
a, I think you that's part of what you all need to kind of sort through is how you're going to run this. So for example, on the overview of policy 300 and 447. Doing that overview, like, is that something you're expecting Julie to come prepared or bring someone
from the police department, or are you expecting like a board member to do that, someone else, or?
So, you know, I was going to get to this with the should there be any guest speakers, but if the answer was no to that, then yeah, that would be one of us on the board that would kind of, because I also envisioned us needing some audio visual things to present in terms of this overview of those policies, just a couple of slides, because reading all of 300 would take about 20 minutes and all of 447 also about 20 minutes.
300 is 10 pages.
Yeah. So if we choose not to do guest speakers, then yeah, I would envision that we would decide who would do, you know, 300 and who would do 447. But if we were to have a guest speaker, in theory, at a minimum, it would probably be someone either from, well, perhaps Sergeant Ray herself, or at least someone from internal affairs, or someone who has familiarity with the how policies are created and how they're changed. But we can move right on to that. I mean, do you think that would be too much capacity to ask for one of us to do that kind of overview, or would it be better to have someone from the department, you know, give an overview of that policy, if anyone has any thoughts on that?
I would think someone from the department, and then we could open it up for discussion between us and the public.
Agree. I mean, we need someone that knows that policy.
Well, then that brings us to, I don't know, Sergeant Ray's calendar.
I can do that.
Okay, at a minimum, Sergeant Ray.
I know we talked about the discussion. I would think we would kind of do maybe one policy and then the discussion and then move on and do the discussion versus okay. All of it at once, because it could get a little muddy.
Okay, so two sections of comment.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know if you'd call it comment or discussion, if it's going to be like a back and forth versus a...
Okay. So that would be maybe we'd shuffle some things around. Yeah. So it would be we'd put that after the overview of the policy, maybe move up the introduction of any citizen submitted written material. We could flex that around.
Yeah, we can just break it into two parts maybe somehow.
Rose, did you have a thought you were looking at? No? Okay. But yeah, I agree with you. So let me try to sketch this out for myself here. So in that case, then maybe we would do call to order, introductions, introduction of any citizen submitted written material, discussion of any prior proposed policy recommendations, overview of 300, roundtable, if that's what you want to call it, discussion, overview of 447, roundtable discussion.
Can I make a slight suggestion on this?
Please.
I think it is helpful, like Jamie suggested, to kind of divide up and do one policy at a time, because if you do have a big turnout, you may end up pushing the second policy to another date.
Okay.
Because I think you'll have a better, kind of more consistent discussion if you go one at a time. And I think it would probably be helpful for those people in the public who maybe haven't really looked in depth at the policies, if you do the overview and then the citizen idea and board idea, and then all the other ideas of the people in the room, because then they'll have seen kind of the overview and what was submitted previously. And
they'll have the context to start
with.
Right. Yeah.
So you might then have those people who haven't really dug in who will come up with some idea or comments just in the course of that. And it may also be that the people who submitted things in writing might actually be there, and they might want to talk more about what they submitted. And I think that the overview piece first gives them an idea of how it all pieces together.
I'm amenable to that.
Another thought would be, do we put some sort of time frames, like from 6 to 7, we're going to talk about this policy, and from 7 to 8, so we're not here till midnight or something, discussing, or if it's going to go over, we...
No, I think it's fair to put some time constraints on there, and then
at a time, is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would, if I were you all, and you all can do however you want, I'd probably look at policy 300, and then once you do everything with 300, if it's too late and you don't want to start 447 to another meeting, then we schedule a separate meeting for that. I think if you compress it, you might lose that engagement piece and the community. If this is really kind of like a listening session of ideas and getting the community involved in what policy review looks like and what that process looks like, and to dig into those policies, you kind of need to have some time in which to do it. Now, you don't want to necessarily go for hours and hours because at some point everyone gets tired. So it might even be you're, you know, 3 hours into policy 300 and there's lots of good conversation, but everybody's getting tired. So then maybe you even have another meeting, you know, just on the second part of policy 300. But I think you need to kind of
have a hard stop for the whole meeting so that we don't.
Right, and I think that would be fair too, you know, with this idea that, you know, what we don't get through, we're going to keep working on it. I don't know. I mean, there are some people here, and they can comment at public time if they feel otherwise. But I think if I was going to something like this, I would feel like I was having more opportunity to be involved than if it was, if you time limit each section too much.
Yeah.
Then it gets kind of awkward, you know, like, oh, well, do we start this next section?
Let's take a couple minute break. Yeah.
And you might also want to think about, you know, how long, you know, where's that hard stop? And do you need, like, for a two hour meeting, that's, you can pretty much go straight through. You hit the 3 hour mark, you need probably a break someplace in there for bathroom break, just people to kind of stretch a little bit. Definitely if you hit the 4 hour mark, you're going to have
that requires an intermission, like a true.
Well, right. I mean, kind of think about, you know, how long you all can go without the breaks and things, because if people are going to take their time to come to something like this, they want to come and be engaged and they want to be heard. So, kind of building it around that concept, if that's what you're going for.
Yeah, I very much like the idea of setting a hard stop on the time, and we can see where we are at that point. Also, if we set a three-hour limit, for instance, and there's an intermission, it may be that people talking in the foyer and stuff like that, you know, things get clarified. If we stop in the middle of a discussion of, say, policy 300, everybody now knows what the discussion is doing, and we could encourage people to do written comments before a follow-up session. So rather than exhaust people and make them feel like I've got to stay here till midnight to get this thing said that I wanted, it might be nice to be able to announce ahead of time that there will be a hard stop here, and if there is much more to be said, we'll continue the session. I think that would make people maybe a little more comfortable.
Well, what feels more reasonable than 2 or 3 hours? Because I kind of feel with 3 hours and then some break built in. But maybe there are other thoughts about that, because I think that makes the most sense. Because if 300 really does produce 3 hours worth of conversation,
let me know for future.
Yeah, we'll know.
Yeah. I'm comfortable with 3 hours with like a 15-minute intermission.
Well, there is a question of food and beverage. Now that it's at this time in the evening, originally my thought was just water and coffee. That may be a little stingy at this. Yeah, you're shaking your head. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're all getting off of work, not getting to go home, no. Coming straight here, spending the entire, you know, evening here. I mean, I think we'll need something. Doesn't have to be big, but something.
Do you remember... it might have been you or Samantha, one of the buffets we had for the training, it was Mexican.
Yeah, the Hy-Vee Mexican bar.
Don't know. Are you going to have an RSVP? Like, how do you know what to...
Well, that would be, we would try and guesstimate how much we would need to order, but we could also try and set up some sort of sign-up beforehand.
Okay.
And then we usually also probably do, like, cookies with that too, so that even if people don't necessarily eat the dinner, sometimes people eat cookies or, you know, something to kind of keep their energy level going.
If anyone is opposed to the Hy-Vee Mexican, you know, speak now, forever hold your peace.
I thought it was great.
I thought it was, you know.
So, I'm okay with that.
We're okay.
We got you.
Well,
Should we start that then? I'm sorry.
Oh, no,
go ahead. 5:30 so people can eat and then... I mean, if we start at 6 and people are getting their plates, the discussion's going to be hard.
It's a lunch and learn.
We could have the food delivered at 5:30 and then, I mean, they usually just set it up and leave it.
Yeah.
So we'll just leave it so if people will get here at whenever, they can just sit and...
It would be better for us to be able to go ahead and eat since we're going
to... I agree. I shouldn't say lunch and learn, dinner and discuss. It's an evening. It's an evening meeting. In terms of audiovisual needs, I won't speak for Sergeant Ray. If we were doing it, maybe we would need a PowerPoint. I don't know if you will need a PowerPoint to do an overview. No?
Just have the policy.
Just have the policy. Okay.
Say this though, Reese. I'm in a meeting every Thursday from noon to 4. To go over policy rewrites. That's what we've been doing. And it does take some time if you know even what you want to go over. So it may be something that you guys will want to look at and kind of write up a little bit before the meeting, if possible, so that we do have discussion points that we can hit on as we go.
I agree. We probably will need a microphone at a minimum, though. Well, would this be in that room right over there?
Yes.
Yeah, let's still do a microphone.
The training room where we were?
Yeah.
1A and 1B over this way.
It's got the...
That's already... We don't even need to record. Okay. Right?
It's got the projection or the...
It has screens. I don't know about microphones, I can ask.
Oh. Yeah. In terms of handouts...
Copies of the policies,
and then if we were to get any submitted material beforehand from citizens, or if we ended up producing, we emailed to you our, proposed policy discussions, or we came together with these talking points, not talking points, discussion points. Mm-hmm. Is there anything else anybody could think of we would need other than the policies or the citizen material, anything that we might produce in terms of, no? Okay. Would anyone like a whiteboard? Would like a whiteboard.
Might already be in there. No.
They move it in and out based on request.
And that would be all that I have on that agenda item. If there's anything else that I would have missed or that you think that we should go back over, anybody? No. At this point.
I would think getting it out, I guess, on the city's website and everything is sooner the better. Or I don't know how that works. So people can sign up if that's what we want to try to do, or get there. Comments submitted.
Once we get that time, because 6 does work for everybody here. I won't speak for anybody that's not here. I don't know what's the quickest we can all respond to a doodle poll. I've been bad about that myself. But once we know that, is that all that you would need from us to?
I thought you all had decided 5:30 for food.
6
oh
o'clock. My goodness!
Yeah, I think we should.
Yeah. I need to stop looking at that.
Well, because I think the date we had doodled, so I'm sure everyone probably thinks it's after business hours, just because we all work.
Yeah. Well then, strike what I said. Then Well, we will move right along then. The next part of our agenda, hiring process for new police chief. Does anyone encounter any new information other than what we were just told from the interim just now?
I talked to the human resources director this morning, and she said that basically within the next couple weeks, everything is going to become clearer. She will then send us more information. They were, and along with kind of the schedule, the process and the schedule will be outlined. So as soon as she gets that to me, I will forward it on to you all.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Audits. We are currently, as you see, a few a few members short tonight, so none of our working groups are complete. So we can't necessarily come to some consensus on the decisions that we would have made in this audit process. So I don't have anything to report from my working group. I don't believe others do either.
Still reviewing.
Can I go back real quick, Reese, to the police chief hiring? We had talked about submitting a recommendation or whatever. I didn't know if we're trying to do that before we get this outline from Human Resources or if it's something we're waiting for more information to do. I know I kind of had emailed the group some ideas, but I didn't know where we stood on moving forward with that or...
So, Rose, you said it'll be a couple of weeks or at least a few weeks before we get that. So, would you say before the next meeting?
My understanding is the Human Resources Director was meeting with the city manager to talk about it today.
Okay.
And I don't know if the final decisions were going to be made today, but she anticipated knowing more about the final process and the schedule of how that process will play out in the next week or so. So, you know, a couple weeks would be the outside. What the interim chief said about idealistically they would have somebody by November, I think that is their goal. Obviously, it would depend upon who they selected and if it was an external candidate, how long that person had to give notice before they could come. I know they were gathering the community input to develop the kind of recruitment material to then try and, you know, say what the community wanted and what the job would be like for part of the recruitment. But that's all I know at this point.
Well, in that event, then we may have a little more time because I did not give you any feedback on what you wrote, but I thought that those priorities that you listed out, all four of them, made sense as things to look for in a police chief. But we could take a little more time to make sure that others are you know giving their input in that or you know their sign off and.
Maybe we could give more input and then have it on the agenda for our next meeting to finalize something to submit.
Yeah. And could we put that on the next agenda?
Sure.
All right, then. New business.
Actually,
New business,
right?
New business. Let me get myself situated here. So there are a couple of policies here. You'll recognize 300. That is, you know, still something that we're going to have the special meeting over. But there was some discussion because we were reviewing different reports, including one that was commissioned by the Department of Justice, the Minneapolis report, and some. There was a lot of discussion about policy 306, specifically with detainment, you know, handcuffing, and then it bleeds in a little bit into 440. And I want to read to you the blurb that kind of provoked some of the conversation because, you know, Doug has done a lot of thinking about this. But this is the blurb that provoked some of it, which was, and this is a quote from that Department of Justice report. Casual use of handcuffing without justification violates the Fourth Amendment. It also violates current MPD policy, which only authorizes handcuffing during a detention in limited 20 circumstances, for example, in limited circumstances, for example, when the person is uncooperative, is dangerous, or may flee. And then there's an ellipses. Handcuffing a person absent an objective safety risk is an unreasonable seizure and violates the Fourth Amendment. And that was from that Department of Justice report. And so from that, I know you had some thoughts and you may want to get into them now.
Well, that was certainly the provocation for me to get quite interested in the handcuffing issue. And I guess the route that I've traveled, you know, it's going to be interesting when we actually start discussing about odds and procedures. They're incredibly dense and complicated and cross-referential and stuff like that. And so I checked the present guidelines that we've got in policies and procedures. I ran some things by Rose so she could do a double check on this. I also talked to Ashley Heiberger, who was the NACOL presenter on use of force about these issues. So what I've tried to do is to distill, none of this is dramatic change or anything like that, but it may be a clarification of present policies and procedures. And what I would be inclined to do, if this makes sense, as we did with motions last month, is to take up each of these things one at a time, discuss them briefly, and see if we can go ahead and pass it. Now, if people are uncomfortable with that because of a limited number of people, of our board members here or something, we can defer it. But I think procedurally what I'm going to do is move these one at a time. Does that make sense to you, Rose?
Yes.
And okay. So our recommendations that we want to advance then, the first one, I would move that one recommendation be that when officers arrest or detain an individual, they should, whenever practicable, offer a reason for the arrest or detention.
Is there a second?
The recommendations, just so I'm clear, to the police chief?
Well, I think that realistically, and I'm looking both ways, I think what all we can do is say what we would like the impact to be. The exact way it's written and which policy it goes into probably has to be worked out in the sort of meetings that you're going to now, Julie, I would think.
But, correct.
So we're saying when
as policy change.
Right, as the policy gets rewritten. I don't think this is a dramatic change, but I didn't find it quite plainly stated. And I worry sometimes that, in effect, somebody can be told that they're under arrest, and there should be a time when they understand what's going on, or they're being detained. And you can imagine that moment and say, well, why am I being detained, and everything like that. Now, there are circumstances we can imagine where an officer can't pause to explain. I'm not saying that there aren't. But I think encouraging officers to make it clear to people what the reason is as soon as it's practicable is the intention of that of this first one. So that's the only thing I would say about that. There might be other discussion of it. I don't know.
But you are making an official motion.
That's an official motion to make that a recommendation.
Second.
Oh, I do. We didn't. I did. We didn't wait for a second.
That's very straightforward. I would second that.
Okay. So, right. Yeah, it did. To get into some of the discussion on this, I feel like that's not controversial to offer people and a reason for being. I think it's probably a de-escalatory thing generally because sometimes that communication can be lacking for whatever reason. And there are some people who are just in different situations who need some extra communication. And whenever practicable does give some breathing room on that. And so I would support this motion. Other discussion? We'll take a vote on it then.
Vote.
Okay. Roll call vote then.
It can be either unless I can't tell who's voting.
I see. Those in favor of this first motion signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? All right. You have a couple more motions.
Yeah, I do. The next one is slightly more complicated. In cases of detention without arrest, the use of handcuffs or other restraints should be avoided when possible. Such restraints may be necessary, however, if there is an articulable and objective safety risk or a flight risk, or if the individual's behavior interferes with an investigation in progress.
Is there a second? I will second it.
So I would ask a question of Julie. Sergeant Ray, number two, there's no official language in the policy today that
I can't tell you exactly what the verbiage is between these three. I would have to look at them and see as far as what that is exactly. Rose, would you be able to send me what his verbiage is on all of these so that I can compare
them? And Rose,
them?
I had sent the previous email that cited the sections in the present regulations that might be useful when you're looking at that, Julie, too.
Okay. Because I know all three of them are fairly long, and they all have different verbiage and different updates in them, so.
Because currently, and this may not be, but I think 306.4.1 currently says the use of restraints on detainees should continue only for as long as is reasonably necessary to assure the safety of officers, others, and any articulable flight risk, and or the severity of the crime investigated. And this would be adjusting that.
It would be adjusting it. If you think about the present wording, it you could, as a logician, you might decide that the minimal amount of time for custody applied is zero in this case.
Yeah.
But the actual wording there suggests it's more about when do you take the cuffs off,
yeah,
rather than when do you put the cuffs on, right? So that's the principle here, is that the decision to cuff in the first place you ought to be able to articulate it's because of a safety risk or because of a flight risk.
And that's language from the Department of Justice, objective safety risk.
Yeah, that's right, exactly right. And if you think about it, it seems inclusive enough. In fact, I did a ride around with an officer today and we discussed it at some length. And he says, well, what about if it's the officer who's endangered? Well, that's an articulable safety risk. Mm-hmm. What if the person's a danger to themselves? That's an articulable safety risk. And I think that language would cover the situations that people worry about.
To me, your proposal here solidifies and spells out in greater detail versus it sounds like now is it's in there, but it's more broad and more general. What you're doing is providing some rails and some better context, I think.
I think that's right. And it's also related, in a sense, to what you'll see as the fourth item on there, which is when somebody files their narrative report and says that they put handcuffs on, well, you know, automatically you're saying, because it fit into one of these categories. So it's, so at any rate, that's the intent there. And again, it is hardly a revolution, but I think it is a clarification of the.
Okay, you would second the motion?
I'd second the motion. I believe we may be ready to vote on it unless there's any other discussion. Seeing none, those in favor would signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? And that would carry.
I did not say either.
Oh, yeah, abstain. I should always ask for abstain.
I want to look at what the policy actually says there versus what you've put here before I can agree to it.
Right.
From now on, I will also ask abstain. That is my mistake as a parliamentarian.
I've reread it several times, and when everybody else is having a conversation, I'm like, I'm just not there yet.
Yeah.
Doug, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So would this be, you would like it added under policy 440, which is contacts, detention, interviews, and interrogations, or just under 306, which is handcuffing and restraints, or 300, which is use of force.
And that, Julie, is precisely the problem we're going to run into over and over again because
right.
of the overlap of the sections.
Sure.
And my intention is not to instruct the department about exactly how to get this idea
where to put
there,
it, just,
or maybe even it's not these words.
Sure.
But let's be clear. If you think about what that one is doing, it's saying, let's not assume that handcuffing is always appropriate, and here are the three things that we're going to be considering. Some of that is, as you say, I don't know where to put it. That seems like a larger question than I can answer because coherence in the whole picture is more
sure.
your business.
And know. That's why we've been meaning to try to rewrite everything and try to clear it. And so if I could get your verbiage from Rose, that would be great so that I can know exactly where to stick it.
I sent both of his emails.
You did send them both.
The one that references the policy numbers,
uh-huh.
that's a preliminary one. You'll see it by the date. And the other one is the one that the board members are aware of.
Great, thank you.
I think that will at least shorten your search, right?
Sure. Yeah.
We've got a couple more.
So the next is to avoid unnecessary conflict, and whenever practicable, offers should offer the individual an opportunity to voluntarily cooperate in the application of restraints before applying them.
Is there a second? I will second this motion. Okay.
So as not to, what I was really trying to address here, which actually Officer Heiberger talked about a little bit with when I was on the phone, is there's a difference between contacting somebody and then putting them in cuffs and giving them an opportunity to respond to your verbal command. Please put your hands behind your back. I'm going to have to cuff you. And so the idea is to try, when it's practicable, to get voluntary compliance before initiating anything that you would do with an involuntary. It's not always going to be practical. We have to acknowledge that. But if it were standard practice, if people just assumed that the first thing I'm going to try to do is get voluntary compliance, it might keep situations from escalating.
That makes sense to me.
Is it just complying with putting on the handcuffs, or is it complying with being detained in general, with or without handcuffs?
Yeah, that's exactly the sort of question that Julie was asking. Are we talking about the whole section having to do with detentions?
Right. Well, because your motion says with the application of restraints, so are you just speaking to that, or are you in general?
I am just speaking at this point with restraints, but. Again, I think what we should be doing as a board, if we think these things are important, is to make sure that the revision includes the ideas, and it's a little hard to say where exactly.
I just think, I mean, to change it to say maybe cooperate with being detained or the application of restraints, I think it's important that it's in, they voluntarily cooperate in regards to either thing, not just in regards to handcuffs. You know what I mean?
I see what you mean.
Yeah, I think I see what you mean too. So I would, if we could figure out how to word it, I would be glad to accept that as a friendly amendment.
You repeat that again. I'm sorry, Jane.
So on number three, to say maybe whenever practical, officers should offer the individual an opportunity to voluntarily cooperate in the application of restraints or being detained, because if they cooperate on just being detained and sitting there, there's no necessary reason to put on to even get to the handcuff part. So I would think maybe just putting in, do they voluntarily cooperate to be detained or be in restraints?
If you think about number two, that takes care of it, though, doesn't it? In effect, it's saying there's no reason to put on, somebody's voluntarily complying, there's no reason to put on the cuffs in the first place. And so what the intent here is, but if you decide that you need to put on the cuffs, see if you can get voluntary compliance before you lay hands on. So I don't know. I mean, does putting those together help with the issue you're seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I know where you're coming from. I guess I just think you don't have number two doesn't say about them complying with it or volunteering to just be a part of this detention versus.
Oh yeah.
And maybe it's not a big deal, but it's just in my head. I'm thinking, I may not volunteer to put on handcuffs, but I might volunteer to sit there and wait until you're done with me.
I hear you.
In a cooperative manner. If you put handcuffs on me, I might be a little less cooperative. I don't know.
Well, you know, we can, or at least this is my thought. I don't want to say table because that's an official, you know.
I'd be comfortable amending it. I don't know if Doug has to do that. I don't know the
rules. So basically, I mean, the things that you've got here right now, this is kind of what we're going to do when we do our special meeting is have these conversations about. So, I mean, I would like to have more time, and I know you did send this out, but I would like to have more time to actually review it.
So you'll want to review all three policies because they all have pieces of what you're saying, but they're all separate.
Yeah.
So if you look at them all combined and kind of review them to figure out exactly what it is you're looking for.
Well, do we have an option to table a motion?
Of course. Yeah, you can. If
would you be be amenable to that? Would that be all right?
Sure. Is this number three we're tabling?
This is number three. Okay. So I'd make a motion to table motion number three.
I'll go ahead and make motion number four, and if people are concerned about it, they can move to table. But
okay, so.
Oh, we had it.
There's
a
motion to table.
Table
are you just
three?
Tabling yep. by agreement and passing it?
Any dissent? Yeah,
tabling by agreement.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. Doug, are you in agreement?
Pardon?
Or oh, yes.
Tabling I'm in agreement.
Okay,
I'm in agreement. Sure. Yeah. And. Caught up with you, Rose? Nope. Okay.
Okay. I'm caught up.
I'll go ahead and move the next one. It may be that it doesn't raise questions in people's mind. We can go ahead and pass it. We could table it. Whenever handcuffs or other restraints have been used in a detention or arrest, the officers involved should include the reason for using them in a narrative report. If you think about it, that's the bookend to number two. That is, why'd you do it? It should be part of the narrative
sense.
Report.
Yeah.
So is there a second on that motion?
I would second that.
Okay. I'd agree with you. That makes sense to me that there should be a reason written out for if you know, because anecdotally, at least in the conversations that I've had, handcuffing seems to be pretty routine, not necessarily reserved for the specific instances of objective safety concern. And so it may be good for a lot of people on a lot of different ends to make sure that is in the code. So I'll be supporting this motion. Seeing no other discussion, those in favor signify by saying aye.
For number four?
For number four.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Abstain? Motion passes.
Reese, I have a question.
Please.
So when you say it should be documented in a report, are you talking full narrative report or a use of force report?
This,
those are two separate things.
This specifies narrative report.
Specifies narrative report.
Okay, because the use of force reports also have a narrative in there of the incident and what happened and why they used the force they used.
My discussions with, I think, as I recall, with Rose, but also with Ashley Heiberger, about this was in most departments this doesn't rise to the level of requiring use of force report, but in many departments it requires your reasons for handcuffing. That's the intention.
I just wanted to be clear on which type of report that you were requesting. So.
Yeah.
Well, we will keep moving along here. In terms of items for next month's agenda, I believe the only thing that we had discussed here tonight would be just agreeing on what we were going to present in terms of the recommendations for what we're looking for in terms of, a new chief of police. But are there other items that people would like added to next month's agenda that are on front of mind at this moment? Well, don't think so. Okay. Well, if any come up, of course, Rose is available by email, phone, bat signal. Anyway you can. Moving on to reports, positive connections and ride-alongs. I believe you've had some.
I spent the afternoon or the middle of the day doing a ride-along with Officer Dylan Caldiero. I cannot pronounce that guy's name.
Nobody can.
I heard somebody call him Colorado, I think, on the way out. I came away having learned quite a bit from the report. By good fortune, we had acquaintances in common on the other side of the law, so to speak, because his beat includes Wilkes Boulevard, where I work with the soup kitchen and the day center. You know, I only want to report that I learned a lot from the experience. So.
Cheryl is not here tonight, so we will not have the Human Rights Commission report, and the Outreach Subcommittee did not meet. And so that would bring us to general comments by public members and staff. Pursuant to Article 4, Section 5 of our bylaws, individual members of the public will be allowed 3 minutes to address the board. Representatives of a group will be allowed 5 minutes to address the board. And so we will go into that now.
Chris Jones, I'm requesting 5 minutes in for Hold Como Accountable, a second ward. Police Chief Jones retired last week, but last week was also marred by two different horrific events in the community, one much more so than the other. The first one that I'm going to talk about, we have had a lot of racism in the police department. On Sunday night, somebody started posting online, start listening to the police scanner. And I unfortunately did not hear this until the next morning. However, I was able to find a whole lot of comments online about this. And apparently it went from on one scanner, there were 50 people listening to it. Within a few minutes, there were over 200 people listening to it. And somebody put quotes on online. And they said that one officer says, we can probably find someone with warrants from here to Andy's. They were talking about going and getting ice cream, a whole bunch of police officers together. And then a second police officer says, check the chicken place. Now, unfortunately, since about 100 years, there's been a really nasty trope going around about black people and chicken. For the white people on the board, that was a really racist comment. The police were really, they were aware. I did send an email, filed a complaint. I did try to sunshine request the audio of that, and I have been denied permission to have access to that audio. I would like for you to make for sure there has, I have been interviewed by IA. However, this I have a really bad feeling that this is going to be swept underneath the rug because of the other thing going on. Plus, the police department has been well known for sweeping racism underneath the rug before. The IA officer who put racist comments on Facebook and Twitter about 4 or 5 years ago. He's been making more comments recently, you know, about how he doesn't think that he's racist. You know, when the police department is saying this, and an IA officer, former IA officer is saying this, you know, this is what goes on. People don't believe this is racist, but this is racist. And then the other thing that happened is a little bit more well-known. It did make news. Mr. Rivera is a young gentleman. He's a black gentleman, 22 years of age, living in an apartment complex for students. Mr. Rivera has mental health issues. He called 911, asked for help. Police came, police left. 911's called again. Mr. Rivera is now dead. Mr. Rivera called for help. This is the reason why we need co-responders. If we had had co-responders, Mr. Rivera more than likely would be alive today because there would have been a therapist, there would have been a counselor, there would have been somebody who recognized that Mr. Rivera needed help He needed somebody more than just to leave him. But instead, his mother and his father Monday had to come and find his body. This is not something that any mother and father should have to do when they send their student off to college, when they send their young one, their young adult, off into the world. My heart breaks for this family because he asked for help and our police department failed him. Thank you.
Thank you.
Renee Carter for Race Matters Friends. And just to follow up on the handcuffing, I was thinking about that as you were discussing the policy, is that Mr. Rivera was also handcuffed after he was shot. And while I understand when he had a gun in his hand, he was dangerous, but when someone's been shot and they need treatment, and I think it says in the policy something about someone's been injured that you shouldn't handcuff them. So, of course, we don't have the records, so we don't know if there was something else going on that they felt endangered. Hopefully we'll get that information, but I think that's something that also needs to be stressed in that policy, is that if you shoot someone and you take their gun away, if they're seriously injured, which he apparently was because he died, you probably don't need to handcuff them. You need to provide treatment. I also wanted to talk about the co-responders just for a few minutes, is that I agree with the interim police chief, Matt Stevens, that they really do need to stress that 24-hour around-the-clock response. And I stress that because I know how agencies work. We work 8 to 5. I'm sorry, there's no one here. And Chief Jones talked to me about that. He goes, well, we've tried to call someone when we needed help, and no one will come because they don't work those hours. And I think we need to help people understand that responding to mental health crisis to avoid people being killed or arrested is imperative. Secondly, they need to be real responders, and I'm not trying to be disrespectful to social workers because I come from that field, but a responder is different than just a social worker. It's someone who is highly trained to respond to dangerous situations. Just to let you know, and then we need to be working on policies. I didn't hear anything about that from the interim police chief. We need to be working on those policies because there's going to be a lot of territorial problems. There's going to be problems of who does what, when, where, and how. And then also Janet Thompson with the county is very interested in how we develop a system where you don't have to arrest people who have mental health crisis. We heard Matt say you arrest them and then you take them to jail. Shouldn't have to do that. The police officer has to go through a whole bunch of different steps when you arrest someone, as opposed to a model that she has where you take the person to the treatment place and they just turn them over and it's less than 5 minutes. Our police officers do not need to be tied up for a long period of time arresting someone and then getting someone to help them when that person needs treatment and police officers need to be back on the street. Sorry, I should have asked for 5 minutes. I didn't. And then I guess my only other thing I wanted to say is not at this last council meeting, but at the previous one, I shared with the council members how much this board has changed, how invested that you are, how hard you're working, how you're really looking at things. And I'm very pleased with the progress that you're making. the work you do needs to be very serious, and we need to find ways for you to be able to give input and be listened to. And so we will be supporting you so that your voices are heard. And unless I'm sick or something happens, I'll be here when you're discussing your policies. Thank you for your service, and thank you for doing the work that needs to be done. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Members, any comments from anyone?
I have something to follow up on the question that you asked Interim Chief Stevens about the calls for service. So we have to report to the state every year what they are, and so there's different categories. So they wanted the overall top five calls for service, and these are actual calls from the public, not self-initiated by officers. Those five were 911 disconnects, traffic-related offenses, trespassing, check the welfare, and assist citizens.
Can you go slower?
Number one again? I'm sorry.
Sure.
911 disconnects, traffic-related something.
Traffic-related calls for service, trespassing, welfare checks.
Hold on. Trespassing, welfare checks.
And assist citizens.
And a what?
Assist citizens. Yes.
It could be a variety of things.
It could be a variety of things, yes. So everything falls under a category, okay? So those are, right. So those are the overall top calls, but then they're broken down over priority calls. So number one, priorities.
Could you send this to me in writing?
I can.
Okay.
So
I'm having trouble keeping up.
So a priority one would be like something that needs an immediate police response. There could be property damage or injury to a person. And those would be accidents, physical disturbances, assist other agencies, alarm calls, or suicide attempts. And then category two is a little bit lesser, right? So we still have to get there fairly quickly, but generally it's not necessarily in progress. No one's going to get hurt. And that's your 911 disconnects, disturbances, trespassing, alarms, or keep the peace. And then category three is a report needs to be taken. Officers need to respond, but there's like no danger at the time. And those are categorized as accidents, suspicious incidents, alarms, suspicious persons, and suspicious vehicles. And again, those can be a variety of things. They just have one overall category. So it's going to be whatever the notes are and however Joint Communications enters that call. And they set the priority, and then they do the dispatch. Make sense?
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay.
Any other?
Rose, I'll send all that to you. I'm sorry, Reese.
Any other comments from staff then?
That made me think of something, I guess. I'm sorry.
No, please.
You just mentioned Joint Communications. I know I've seen or heard that that's needing, right? We're shorthanded in that.
They work for Boone County.
Okay, so we don't
so
know.
So I don't know what their staffing levels are.
Okay.
And so they dispatch for the entire county. So like Ashland, us, Boone
all
County.
Hallsville, the rest.
Yeah, all of them.
I thought
that's
that
they're
very short.
That they're short-staffed?
Yeah. That's what I've heard as well.
Okay. Well, I do not believe that we are having anything on our agenda that would necessitate us going into closed session today. So I could be incorrect about that, but I believe I'm not. And so our next meeting will be Wednesday, September 13th, 6 p.m. here. And I look forward to meeting with all of you once again, assuming that, you know, I am also not struck down with some disease or, you know, out of the, you know, traffic incident or anything else. But seeing no other business, I would entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Okay, and we'll have a roll call vote on this.
You don't need roll call.
Oh, we don't need a okay, well.
Just to go into closed session, but not
just to go into closed session. Look at me. Okay, learning my Robert's rules here, and live and in color. So, just the voice vote.
So, yeah. It can just be all in favor.
Oh,
but
no.
Right now I have Stephen and Jamie made the motion, and Stephanie and Doug, did you both second?
No, I kept my mouth shut.
Okay, so Stephanie seconded.
My bad, I jumped on that. Mm-hmm.
Right. Well then, those in favor of adjourning would signify by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Abstaining?
You good?
And we are adjourned.
And you did.